Welcome to Urbanism Vancouver, a podcast that explores how our built environment shapes our everyday lives and community experiences. I'm your host, Helen Loy. Join me as we discover where we live, work, and play, and how we can shape better communities. With each episode, we'll bring a bit of insight and industry experience from myself and my guests. We'll dive into the inner workings of our urban surroundings and explore how places are planned, designed, and built, and discuss ways to create more livable, equitable, and sustainable cities. I hope that you'll learn a little and be inspired to be more curious and more involved in impacting positive change. Before we get started today, we want to acknowledge that this podcast is recorded and produced on the traditional and unceded territories of the Coast Salish peoples, including the Musqueam, Squamish, and the Tsleil-Waututh Nations. We pay our respects to their elders past, present, and emerging, and recognize the enduring connection they have to this land. We strive to have our conversations contribute towards reconciliation and work towards sustainability and equity for all the custodians of the lands. We've heard extensively about the various community and climate benefits to promoting active transportation and safer streets. In our last episode, we also heard about some of the small steps we can all take to shift our daily practices to walk the walk. But how do we talk the talk and ensure that we also have governments moving in the right direction? Today, we will hear from Lucy Maloney, who has been working with a variety of groups and agencies to advocate for changes, and also we'll hear about some of the challenges that come with this advocacy work.
Well, I'm originally Australian and I've got a legal background, and I ended up in Vancouver via Melbourne, Western Australia, Singapore, Santiago, Chile, and we've been here for 6 years, and I'm a very freshly hatched Canadian. I had my citizenship ceremony on Tuesday this week, so So congrats. Here's to all Canadian things, and I'm very much looking forward to exercising my right to vote sometime very soon.
I know you do quite a lot of work for kind of safe streets and for better recycling infrastructure. Are there groups that you've been advocating with most frequently in the last little while here in Canada?
Yeah, I do tend to hop between different groups. I until very recently been the chair of the Parent Advisory Council for Lord Roberts Elementary School, and now I've moved on to a position, the Safe Routes to School Advocacy Working Group for Active Travel. I'm going to be leading that working group, which is going to be fantastic. And I've been volunteering for quite a while with Hub Cycling on their Vancouver UBC committee. And I also have my own little organisation called Love the Lane. And that sprung out of the aftermath of the municipal election that happened about a year and a half ago in Vancouver, where the ABC supermajority swept into power. And one of the first things they talked about the very morning after the election result came in was taking out the separated bike lane on Stanley Park Drive. And I'm sure we'll probably talk about that a bit further on. But yeah, that was the genesis of Love the Lane. I also volunteer with Vision Zero Vancouver. My role there tends to be spokesperson of last resort because, unfortunately, due to the Stanley Park stuff, I've had quite a lot of media experience. And I think that's about it for the moment. Yeah, that's probably about it for the moment. So,
well, that was a long list.
So, yeah. My main interest is generally safe routes to school, although I am really fixated on the Portside Greenway at the moment and how it could, in a perfect world, extend bidirectional active transport access right through Gastown, through to Hornby Street, past the Waterfront Station. So that's one of my other pet things that I'm trying to convince people to let go ahead.
There's so many different terms going around when it comes to the world of cycling and advocacy for cycling or even safe streets. So I've heard things like micromobility or active transport or like you just said, safe streets. Maybe can you give us a little bit of an overview of kind of what are the key goals of the advocacy work that you do, specifically in the context of, you know, people might say in the city like Vancouver, oh, I see bike lanes all around, or I see people cycling. So what do you need to advocate for? What is it that people are trying to encourage more of?
Well, my advocacy is very broad ranging, and it really stems from a few different areas. I'm extremely concerned about climate change. So all my advocacy is to try and extend the rights of people outside cars. And that's about climate. It's about social justice. It's about public health goals more than anything else. I mean, it's when we get people outside cars and using active transport, they take up less space in a city, which is really helpful. It actually does a favour to people in cars if we can get people taking transit, walking, using bikes or e-scooters to get around. And it's safe and convenient for them to do so. There are fewer cars on the road. And that's a key part of why I advocate for safe routes to school, particularly, because there are so many people that are left out when we prioritise motor vehicle transport in our cities, especially. Anyone that's too young to have a driver's licence or too old to safely drive a car or who can't afford to have access to a private car or who is disabled in a way that precludes them from independently owning and operating a private motor vehicle. All those people, basically second-class citizens, when we prioritise the convenience over drivers, both in the physical form of our streets but also with our public expenditure, over the safety and convenience of people outside cars. It's a social justice issue because, and I'm especially interested in the rights of children, when kids can't actually roam about their neighbourhoods safely, they can't get themselves to and from school safely, they can't go and visit friends, they can't go to the shops safely by themselves, studies show that their physical and mental health suffers. So every time we make choices in the design of our cities that prioritise adult drivers ahead of everybody outside cars, it is a social justice issue.
And so for listeners or for people, you know, like myself, who don't have children and aren't as familiar with the day-to-day logistics of taking children to school, to and from school, what are some of the physical things that you are seeing that would highlight how it is unsafe currently and how it's currently prioritizing drivers over the safety of children?
Yeah, it's I'm especially interested at the moment in secondary schools because there are a lot more elementary schools and the catchments are therefore smaller. But once we get to secondary schools, they're much larger and the catchments are much larger and secondary school children are much more likely to be travelling to and from school unaccompanied by adults. And you get this kind of negative feedback loop where parents feel worried about their children crossing the road and making their own way to and from school. So what they do is they drive them to and from school, which adds to the traffic, which adds to the danger. So when we create safe routes to school using infrastructure, we get people out of cars, we free up parents to travel to their own jobs instead of having to travel to a school to drop a child off and then on to their own jobs or whatever they other commitments they have during the day. So it's actually really good for parents if they don't need to drive their kids to school in a car. And it's really great for kids because they get to develop those risk management and risk evaluation skills that you need to become a fully fledged, responsible grown-up who is capable of navigating their way around cities.
What are some of the infrastructure examples that you're talking about? Is there anything around the city of Vancouver that people might have seen if they've walked by a school that would be considered infrastructure to ensure that it's safer for children and students to walk to school on their own?
Yeah, well, ideally, I would like to see the active transport, the official network, travel past all schools and community centres so that you had separated bike lanes or school streets in front of running adjacent to every school so that kids can get safely right to the door of a school, especially secondary school students who might want to ride a bike from home. Or you might have raised zebra crossings so that drivers have to physically slow down to get over a raised crosswalk or a speed hump, that so they physically have to slow down. What is most effective in slowing down drivers? Physical impediments that risk them damaging their car. That is what motivates people. So narrower general vehicle lanes are a good visual cue to drivers to slow down. And these raised crosswalks are so fantastic because they give the perception that the driver is entering pedestrian territory, so they have to go up into pedestrian territory rather than the pedestrians having to descend onto driver territory. And also, if you've got a crossing that is the same level as the sidewalk or footpath, it also can be more accessible to people who use wheelchairs or accessibility mobility scooters, because they, you know, especially if it's raining or snowing or there's a leaf buildup, you know, that can make gutters very difficult to cross. So that's another thing that is kind of a social justice issue relating to traffic calming infrastructure that we would like to see, especially around schools and community centres.
Lucia has given us a great list of tangible examples of physical infrastructure that can help slow down vehicle movement, which in turn promotes greater safety and more space for those outside of vehicles, such as pedestrians and cyclists. She then talks about some of the challenges she's facing with advocating for safer streets.
It's been a super big challenge, and one of the reasons why it is such a challenge is that generally it involves the implementation of traffic calming infrastructure, and particularly school streets, involves restricting the access of adult drivers, either to parking or to altogether to a street adjacent to a school, and reallocating space effectively from adult drivers for the movement and storage of motor vehicles to kids. And even adults who drive kids to and from school, even though their kids, you know, would benefit from traffic calming infrastructure, sometimes the perception of a driver, and I'm a driver as well, so I can attest to this, you're always trying to drive the most direct route and park as close as possible to your destination. And sometimes this means that we as adults advocate for things that aren't in the best interests of our non-car owning kids. And especially if we don't have kids and we're just worried about getting to and from work, although that's not a general rule. Some people are very selfless in that regard, even more than some parents. But I don't know, speaking for myself, driving brings out the worst in me. So I can really understand why people, you know, driving is such a pain in the butt already. You know, sitting in traffic and being frustrated and being in a rush and having to find a car parking spot, that I understand why drivers see any bike lane or a speed hump or a restriction on where they can drive as being, oh, it's already such a pain and so hard and so soul-destroying driving. This is one thing that would just make it even harder, even though that's not always the case and it can make it easier. There's absolutely no hope that we're going to convince everybody that that they should get out of their cars, and neither should we need to. What we need to do is, like we've been doing, but, you know, ramp it up a lot more. We need to provide really great, convenient, direct, safe, pleasant infrastructure so that when people do get on bikes, they don't have bad experiences that put them off. Then they don't have to take circuitous routes through industrial areas or find it difficult to get across roads because there's no light on a busy road, that kind of thing, to just make it more pleasant and convenient for people.
So to that point about safety, I may or may not know this, but some people might be familiar with ads, for example, that might say, you know, safety is a shared responsibility. So that means perhaps putting on a high-vis vest whenever you're going about on a dark, rainy day, or making sure that, you know, you're not on your phone, or, you know, don't step out on the crosswalk whenever it's close to turning red. So why isn't that, I guess, enough or a good approach when it comes to safety for pedestrians and cyclists?
That's not just not a good approach. It's an absolutely terrible, counterproductive approach if what you're interested in is actually reducing the harms that cause deaths and injuries on our roads to people outside cars. Because I don't know about you, but I taught my kids the minute they could understand it, the minute they were mobile, and I'm sure my parents were the same with me, I taught them to be careful crossing the road, to look both ways, to not step out, you know, to hold my hand, you know, see terrified parents clutching onto their kids and chasing after them as they run off towards an intersection. People know already, people outside cars just are so brutally aware that they are in danger every time they go step onto a roadway when they're trying to cross the road. And they're even in danger when they're still on the sidewalk, as we've seen. We've had some absolutely disastrous collisions where cars have crashed into each other and ended up injuring people on the sidewalk. I mean, I can think of, you know, there was the baby that was killed in their parents' arms near Smythe Street in the centre of town. There was the poor child on the corner of Arbutus and Cornwall in Kits that had a car career off into them when they were waiting to go to the beach. So we really have already an enormous amount of awareness of what the dangers are. But we know that the causes of deaths and injuries on our road are primarily, like, speed is the number one cause of death and injury on our road, the speed of motor vehicles. Anyway, and the other thing we need to do is regulate vehicle design. You know, the motor vehicles keep getting bigger and bigger, and the bigger a motor vehicle is, the less likely someone outside a car is likely to survive a collision.
I asked Lucy to give us examples of measures that we could enforce to reduce vehicle speeds and to encourage greater safety on our streets.
So the things that we can do is we can install traffic calming infrastructure to make sure that speeds are controlled, that drivers are forced to slow down and they're given visual cues that they need to go more slowly. We can also use automated enforcement so that it's not an ad hoc every now and then approach. If drivers know that they're very likely to get a ticket, then they're very likely to worry about whether they're speeding or not. But that's not the case in Vancouver. We have very few speed cameras. And I understand that you don't get a ticket until you've gone 20 kilometres an hour above the speed limit. I do not get that. I had a Melburnian friend staying with us recently, and he told me that now in the centre of Melbourne, which is my original hometown, in downtown, the speed limit has been reduced to 40 kilometres an hour right across downtown. And there are red light cameras and speed cameras at every single intersection, right? And if you speed by more than 3 kilometres an hour, so if you go 43 or over, you'll get a ticket, wow, right? And every car gets a ticket, and you can get multiple tickets. So you don't just get one ticket for your trip through town. If you go at 45 kilometres an hour through every single intersection across the centre of Melbourne, you will get multiple tickets, and that can become very, very expensive very quickly. So guess how effective that is at getting drivers to slow down. It's super effective.
I can imagine, yeah.
And there's automated enforcement of cell phone use. There are cameras that are above that. If you're using your cell phone while you're in control of a motor vehicle, you get a ticket. There's automated enforcement of, well, it would be left turns here, but right turns in Australia. And, you know, I, who lectures people about behaving themselves on the roads and try to be very careful, I have had a turning too late on an arrow ticket and a speed ticket in Melbourne when I've only been going a tiny little bit outside the law. But, you know, that's what happens, and that really focuses the mind. You know, it's the exception in Melbourne that people exceed the speed limit and run red lights, not the rule, whereas here there just seems to be very few consequences.
So clearly it works, having the enforcement and the fines as reminders. So why is it that we don't do that here more often? Is it an issue of capacity, or is there just no political will to add these systems to encourage enforcement?
Well, I think that it's absolutely a combination of the media and political lack of courage. You'll remember that when a motion was moved to ask the province to install more speed cameras recently, the City of Vancouver, the ABC majority amended that motion to do more study instead of actually ask for those speed cameras. But if you look at the media coverage of that, the absolute number one thing that was asked, I was asked this twice in one interview on CKNW, was, is this a cash grab? And they're, doing polls of their listeners. Do you think it's a cash grab? Is it a cash grab? I can tell you that the absolute best way of avoiding a cash grab is to just obey the law. And that's right. Not a cash grab. But there's this idea that when we put consequences in the way of drivers, that it's somehow not a legitimate use of government authority and shouldn't be allowed. But you should be able to exceed the speed limit by over 20 kilometres an hour with impunity and not get a fine. Blows my mind. You always got to look at who has power in our society and, which companies are the most prolific advertisers on the commercial media, which is car companies. Yes. Look at what happens when ICBC has an opportunity to change our laws. Motorists are perceived to be the powerful voices in society. So we're always changing things to make driving cost less and be more convenient and more enjoyable, which is actually completely counterproductive because of what it does is induce demand and put more traffic on our roads.
I think it's going to require a little bit more political courage, as you mentioned, to do the things that clearly are proven to be effective at making our streets safer.
Yeah, and the thing is that it's hard in the moment, but it always ends up well. I mean, look back at the Burrard Bridge bike lanes. That's always right. A classic example. The mayor got death threats. It was like 13 years ago or something that went in. And everyone thought it was going to be a disaster. And now only the most extreme anti-bike people would even imagine seriously asking for those bike lanes to be removed. They're accepted. People realise the world didn't end. It's better for drivers because, it's put cyclists out of harm's way and they don't need to have to worry about hitting cyclists. And it's just hugely increased accessibility to downtown from the Burrard Bridge and encourage a lot more active transport use.
Yeah, that's the route I take to go to Stanley Park is over the Burrard Bridge. And funnily enough, I only started doing that really after the pandemic, after the separated bike lane came in, right? Which brings me to my next topic of the separated bike lane at Stanley Park. So my memory might be a little bit fuzzy on this one, but I believe the separated bike lane along Beach Ave and English Bay was put in kind of at the start of pandemic and continued throughout Stanley Park. And I understand what had happened was that, with the latest city council that had been put in, as well as the park board, that was then taken out. And so one of the complaints that people had was this idea that it was taking up a lane of car traffic, of people being able to drive through the park and get to the things like the tea house or just even generally enjoy the park. I understand there's also a bike lane along the seawall. So why is the seawall not enough? And what is the rationale for having a fully separated bike lane in addition to that?
The seawall is one of the most beloved and scenic attractions. Everyone loves the seawall, but it's got some drawbacks. Firstly, it's that for the first 30% of the route, it's great. It's nice and wide. It runs parallel to the road. It's got beautiful views. Then you get to the first of three inaccessible gates when you are going down to the splash park. So that automatically makes it inaccessible for hand cyclists who can't dismount, people with trailers where they're taking their kids in a bike trailer. If you've got oversized or non-standard bike, it's really hard to get through. Then it gets more narrow. You've got what's called vertical separation. So you've got a curb from the bike lane down to the walking lane. And the bike lane has tree branches overhanging it. So you've got to duck your head. An inaccessible gate right near Prospect Point down the bottom. And there's another one at Third Beach. And it's fine. It's flat. It's great if you want to go and look at the beautiful views every now and then. But if you're wanting to do a workout ride, it's flat instead of being able to go up the hill. If you want to go through the forest and it's a hot, sunny day, it doesn't go through the forest. It goes around the edge. If you want to access any of the attractions inside the park, bad luck. There's not only very few exits off the seawall into the middle of the park, but there's zero signage saying go this way, exit here for the aquarium. So it's no good for transport within the park. And it's also closed all the time. You know, in winter, there are, I think, at least 2 weeks of scheduled cliff stabilization maintenance. And then you'll have trees falling and mudslides and ice and snow and king tides. And if you have storm events like you've had the last few years, then it's closed for months while they repair it. Just for resilience to climate change, you just need an alternative route, apart from the fact that cyclists want to access all parts of the park, not just the very outer edge of the park. So the seawall is limited.
Lucy has pointed out a variety of reasons why the seawall is not a sufficient route for active transportation, especially considering the importance of promoting cycling and walking for a more climate-friendly future. Lucy then dives into the political and media coverage of the Stanley Park bike lane issue and why it has become such a contentious issue in the public.
You'll remember for the first couple of months of the pandemic, the Beach Avenue bikeway was installed just with orange cones, and the park, Stanley Park, was kind of completely closed to private motor vehicles, except that people from the yacht club and the rowing club still could get in and deliveries could still get in. So that was 2 months. And then an orange cone bike lane was installed so that one lane was allocated to cyclists and active transport and one lane was allocated to drivers. But what we saw was a really disingenuous, opportunistic political culture war fight where all sorts of misinformation was put out that you couldn't get into the park. You could get into the park in a motor vehicle and you had a lot more access to the park outside a motor vehicle, but you got a lot of unfortunate complaining by the businesses in the park, blaming all their woes on this bike lane, even though I remember the border was shut to tourists. There were restrictions on the number of people you could have in a restaurant that were mandated by the province. But amazingly enough, this was still all blamed on the bike lane rather than the fact that a lot of people were not dining out because they were worried about the risk of COVID.
With something that has the potential to impact the iconic kind of jewel of our city, the Stanley Park, I'm sure the city must have studied this and sort of come to a conclusion as to which is the right way to proceed. So was there some sort of, I understand there might have been like a mobility study that was,
yes,
that was done. And so what was the findings and recommendations from this?
Well, the Stanley Park Mobility Study is still underway, and I'm hugely enthusiastic about the fact that they are doing this study. I mean, it is the biggest park in Vancouver and most popular, huge tourist destination, beloved by locals equally. So I'm really pleased that a proper study is being done with the whole range of stakeholders to find out what the problems actually are. Because if you look at Stanley Park, I don't know when the current configuration was put in place. It would have been, I don't know, decades ago, peak car supremacy, right? If you look for disabled people who arrive in cars, they're really not very well served once they get out with the current configuration, which really made me confused when you'd hear people throughout this anti-bike lane campaigns talking about the interests of disabled people using mobility aids. Because if you look, I mean, I'm riding around Stanley Park Drive a lot, and so I have plenty of time to think about this, but there are so few curb cuts. You know, if you look around just above the splash park, there's this one ramp that's been glommed on to a curb to try and...
I've seen that.
Yeah. But if you keep looking, there's almost no sidewalk and there are no curb cuts. So it's great if you bring somebody with mobility challenges into the park, or they're able to get there by themselves. But then once they're there, they have a really hard time getting around. There are very few safe crossings. I mean, if you're into urban planning at all or landscape architecture, I think one of the things that people are into is studying desire lines. I used to call them pathways of desire, but that sounded a little bit sexual when I've been corrected a few times. But there are all these little paths worn through the grass,
yes.
Where you should have a paved path. And I, you know, if you listen to wheelchair users, that the gravel paths are often very difficult for them to use, even the ones designated as being accessible, because they've got steep sections or deep gravel. I mean, and this is what the Stanley Park Mobility Study should be looking at, is how to help every type of mode user navigate around the park in a way that reduces private motor vehicle use and increases incentives for active transport, particularly walking, particularly people who are disabled, particularly people that want to bring kids.
In addition to what people can do officially through some of the groups you've listed, like Hub, Vision Zero Vancouver, Love the Lane, or even getting involved with their local elementary or secondary school, what can the general public do in order to become more aware about some of the issues with concerning, you know, creating safer streets or promoting more prioritization for pedestrians and cyclists? What can an average person do, I guess, to follow along and to help with this advocacy effort?
Well, I think a really simple thing that's very beneficial is just seeking out people who are passionate and interested in these issues on social media. I mean, I'm not on TikTok, but I hugely admire some of the active transport advocates who work on TikTok, or, I mean, you know, my natural habitat is probably more Twitter, but Instagram's very good. I think that there are such good people doing little videos on YouTube as well. And you can always find recommendations of books to read and articles to read that gives you a bit more of an education as to what really works to encourage active transport and reduce deaths and injuries on our roads, and how housing might work well to solve some of these problems. I really have been very lucky to be close friends with Jeff Lee, who's the president of Hub Cycling, and he has really taken me on as a bit of a pet project, and he takes me on bike rides, and we have long phone discussions in which he tells me the history of everything in Vancouver and this bike lane and that bike lane, and which strip of land is owned by which government authority, and why this won't work, but if you try this, that might work, and who's who in the city. And I've been so lucky. I've got a really good group of mentors and role models who really help me to learn what I need to know to be a more effective advocate.
Do you have a book recommendation for someone who might be kind of dipping their toes into some of these issues?
All right. My two favorite books at the moment, Right of Way by Angie Schmidt and There Are No Accidents by Jesse Singer. They are such great books. I mean, I've always had a real awareness of the content of There Are No Accidents because I actually worked as a prosecutor at the Environment Protection Authority, in-house lawyer at the Environment Protection Authority in Melbourne for about a decade. And we always used to have companies, you know, have a spill or do something and say, oh, it was an accident. It was like, you know, where's your management plan? And you needed to do all these things to anticipate the problems you were going to have and prevent them. and do preventative maintenance and make sure staff were properly trained and have systems in place. So it's there are no accidents, as it says on the book. There are no accidents.
Yeah. No, we've all seen some of those documentaries about the various, you know, large chemical spills or oil spills and whatnot. And I guess that's a very similar idea, I guess, when it comes to pedestrian and injuries that happen to people on the roads, right? We're designing, and that's why it's happening. I think we're very fortunate that you have decided to relocate here as a newly Canadian citizen, because I love your passion. I love that you have time and energy to dedicate to all these various groups. I want to thank you for, you know, taking the time today to chat with me about this and share a bit about what it is that you've been working on.
It's an absolute pleasure. Thank you.
There are too many people negatively impacted by the way we are prioritizing cars on our streets. We have no excuses for the many lives impacted, lost, and at risk every day when we know these dangers are fully preventable. We must prioritize safety in the way we design our streets. That will require us to first change our baseline expectations about driving. When we prioritize being able to drive everywhere quickly, we're also prioritizing infrastructure that allow for these high speeds at the cost of everyone outside vehicles. The reality is, speed kills, and we must slow down vehicles. There are so many ways we can make streets safer for everyone. We can have more automated enforcement, incentivize the purchase of fun alternatives, or simply add more space for pedestrians, cyclists, and everyone else on the streets outside of vehicles. Let's demand better infrastructure and transportation options for safer and healthier cities. You've been listening to Urbanism Vancouver, the podcast dedicated to bettering our built environment. Be sure to follow us on your listening platform of choice so you don't miss our future releases. I'm Helen Loy. Thanks for listening. This podcast series was independently funded and produced by myself and Aaron Johnson. Visit us at urbanismvancouver.com.